Day minus 3, 0800. Jen's eyes open. She is in bed. And it's the 26th. It's day minus 3. She goes to the picture window. It's raining outside. Where is this going to end? Cycling back, what, forever? Until she ceases to exist? She needs to know the rules. That is what any lawyer would do. Understand the statute, the framework, and then you can play the game. All she knows so far is that nothing has worked. She can only infer from travelling backwards that she hasn't managed to stop the crime. Surely, stop the crime, stop the time loop. That must be the key. She hastily refreshes her email, looking for a reply from Andy Vertese, but there's nothing. She goes downstairs to find Todd hunting for something. On top of the TV unit, Jen says. She knows he will be looking for his physics folder. She knows because she's his mother, but she also knows because this has already happened. Ah, thanks, he throws her a self-conscious grin. Quantum today. God, he towers over her. He used to be many feet shorter than her, would reach his right arm right up vertically when he was on the school run, his warm hand always finding hers. He'd get frustrated if she couldn't take it when she was fussing with her handbag or reaching to press the button on the traffic lights. She had felt guilty each time. It's crazy the things mothers feel guilt over. And now look, over a foot taller than her and refusing to meet her gaze. Maybe she had been right to feel guilty, she thinks hopelessly. Maybe she should have never done anything except hold his hand. She could come up with 1,000 maternal crimes, letting him watch too much television, sleep training him, the lot, she thinks bitterly. Do you know who Joseph Jones is? She says quietly, watching him carefully. Not to see if he tells her, but to see if he lies about it, which she thinks he will. A mother's instincts are better than any lawyer's. Todd puffs air into his cheeks, then plugs his phone in the charger on the kitchen island. Nope, he says, a studied frown crossing his features. He's never once charged his phone there before school. He charges it overnight. Why? He asks. Jen appraises him. Interesting. He could have easily said, Cleo's uncle's friend, but he chose not to, just as she expected. She hesitates, not wanting to do something big, wanting to plan her moment. Doesn't matter, she says. All righty, mysterious Jen, more a question than an axiom. Shower time. Todd leaves his phone charging. Jen stands there in the kitchen without a theory, without a hope, and with the only person who might be able to help lying to her. She glances at the stairs. She's got between 5 and 20 minutes. Todd sometimes takes long and contemplative showers, sometimes quick ones, rushing so much to get dressed afterwards that his clothes stick to his wet skin. She tries to get into his phone, but fails the PIN request twice. She dashes upstairs. She'll search his room instead. She's got to find something useful. Todd's room is a dark cave, painted bottle green, curtains closed. A double bed with a tartan cover on it sits underneath the window. A television faces the bed. There is a desk in the corner underneath the stairs that lead up to her and Kelly's bedroom. It's neat but not cosy, the way many men keep their spaces. A black lamp and a MacBook sit on the otherwise empty desk. An exercise bike leans against the far wall. She opens his laptop and fails that password login twice too. She looks around his bedroom, thinking how best she can use the time. Frantically, she opens his desk drawers and the ones in his bedside tables and looks under the bed. She pulls the duvet back and feels around in the bottom of the wardrobe. She just knows she's going to find something. She can feel it. Something damning. Something she can never forget. She ransacks the room. She'll never be able to get it straight again, but she doesn't care. She's already wasted 6 minutes. One unit of legal time, an hour divided into tenths. Her gaze lands on his Xbox. He's always on it. He must talk to some people on there. It's worth a shot. She powers it up, listening out for the shower, then navigates to the messenger section. It's a dark world in there. Messages with random people about spooky games, fighting games, games where you earn enough points to buy knives to stab other players with. She goes to the recent sent items, which has two messages in. One to user78630 and one to Connor18. The first says, OK. The one to Connor says, 11 p.m, I'll drop it off. She will ask Pauline about Connor, see if he's wrapped up in anything. It seems too much of a coincidence that they've started spending time together just as Todd goes off the rails. And 11 p.m. drop-offs, that doesn't sound good. She turns off the console and leaves Todd's room. Seconds later, he opens the bathroom door. They meet on the landing. He has only a towel around his waist. She meets his eyes, but he doesn't hold her gaze for long. She can't gauge his mood. She recalls his facial expression from the night of the murder. There wasn't any remorse on it, not anywhere, not even a bit. What's the point in going to the office if, when she wakes up tomorrow, it will be yesterday? There is, for the first time in Jen's adult life, no point in working at all. She muses on this while feeding Henry VIII. She tries calling a number she finds listed for Andy Vertese, but gets no answer. She Googles him again. He won some science award yesterday for a paper on black holes. She emails two more people who have written theses on time travel. She thinks about how to convince her husband of what is happening. Jen sighs and eventually finds a legal pad full of notes on a case that doesn't seem to matter much right now. All she can hear is the soft hum of the heating. In the notebook she writes, day minus three, what I know. She writes underneath that, Joseph Jones's name, his full address. Cleo may be involved. Connor, drop-offs. It isn't a lot. For the first time in years, Jen is on the school run. The green school gates are clotted with parents. Cliques, loners, people dressed up, people very much dressed down, the lot. Jen would usually spend her time at the school gate, paranoid everybody was talking about her. But today, she wishes she had done this more often. For starters, it's fascinating. She spots Pauline immediately. She is alone, has lately been insisting on collecting Connor so she knows he's been to school. He was recently told off for skiving, and then goes on to get her youngest, Theo. She is wearing a denim jacket and a huge scarf, is staring down at her phone, her legs crossed at the ankles. I thought I'd try one of these school-run things, Jen says to her. I'm genuinely honoured, Pauline says, looking up with a laugh. Everybody here is a dick. Honestly, Mario's mum has a mulberry handbag with her for the school run. Pauline is one of Jen's easiest friends. Jen did her divorce 3 years ago, separating her neatly from her cheating husband, Eric. Pauline had turned up at Jen's firm for an initial consultation, screenshots of Eric's infidelity in hand. Jen had known of her from the school, but had never spoken to her. She made Pauline a tea and very professionally looked at the damning texts sent from Eric to his mistress and said she'd take Pauline's case on. Sorry you had to see them, Pauline had said in Jen's office, pocketing her phone and sipping the tea. Yes, well, it's good to have the, evidence, Jen had said, and despite herself, her stiff suit, the corporate surrounds, she felt her expression falter. However, graphic. Pauline met her eyes for just a second. So, do you attach dick pics to the court petition? She had said, and right there in Jen's office, they had exploded into laughter. That was the first time I'd laughed since I found them, Pauline had said sincerely later, and just like that, a friendship was born, out of tragedy and humour, as they often are. Jen had been so pleased when Connor and Todd had become friends too, until now. Well, you've got me here, I'm washed, Jen says. Pauline smiles and scuffs a Converse shoe on the floor. You're not working today? Todd appears in the distance, loping along with Connor, one of the only students who is taller than him. Thicker set, too. A unit of a kid. No. How's things? How's your enigma of a husband? Listen, Jen says, skipping past the small talk. Uh-oh, Pauline says. I don't like that lawyerly listen. Nothing to worry about, she says lightly. Todd is, I think, maybe caught up in something. In what? Pauline says, suddenly serious. For all her humour, she is a formidable mother where it matters. She will tolerate smoking and swearing, Jen thinks, but nothing worse. Look at her here, checking Connor has made it to school. I don't know, I just... Todd is acting strangely, and I just wondered, has Connor? Pauline tilts her head back just a fraction. I see. Exactly. More parents begin to gather around them by the gates. 11-year-olds and 15-year-olds greet their parents, and Jen thinks how she's only done this a handful of times, instead choosing to sift through disclosure at the office, appraising trainees, making bundles of documents, earning money. She wonders now quite what it was all for. "He seems fine," Pauline says slowly, and Jen is so thankful suddenly here for her friend, who has understood the subtext and chosen not to take offence. "But let me do some digging," she adds, right before Connor and Todd arrive. "All right," Connor says to Jen. He has a tattoo that looks like a necklace, rosary beads maybe, disappearing into the neck of his T-shirt. "Tattoos are a personal choice," Jen tells herself. "Stop being snobby." He takes his cigarettes out of his pocket, which Jen is relieved to see Pauline wince at. He flares the lighter while still staring at Jen. The flame illuminates his face for the briefest of moments. He gives her a wink, so fast you'd miss it if you weren't looking for it. "It's been a difficult evening. Todd left as soon as he got home. 'Going to Cleo's?' he said." He had been irritated by Jen's appearance at the school pickup and annoyed with Kelly too. "Can either of you two get hobbies?" he'd said when they were all at home by 4 o'clock. After he left, Jen looked up Cleo on Facebook. She is a couple of years older than Todd, but in education still, an art college nearby. Her page is meticulously curated. Model-like shots of her, a strangely high number of political memes, a lot of bunches of flowers, pretty innocuous teenage stuff. Jen is going to go and see her, soon, she has decided, to talk to her. She tidies up, thinking about what Pauline might find. "It's useless to clean," she acknowledges as she scrubs at the kitchen countertops and stacks the dishwasher. When she wakes up, yesterday, none of this will have been done. But isn't that kind of always the way housework feels? Pauline calls her 20 minutes later. "I have spoken to Connor," she says. She always speaks without any introduction at all, always gets straight to the point. "And I've done some digging." "Shoot." Her arms feel chilled as she draws the curtain across their patio doors. "I've checked Connor's phone. Nothing suspicious. A few unfortunate photographs," takes after his father. "Jesus. What's going on with Todd?" "He seems to know these older men, an uncle and a friend of his new girlfriend. There's a weird vibe at their house. Plus, they own a company called Cutting and Sewing Limited. It's brand new, no turnover, no accounts. I think it's got to be a front. Pretty unusual for two blokes to set up a sewing company, right?" "Right. That all?" Jen sighs. Obviously not, but the rest is unbelievable. A dark underworld ending in a murder that she's got to crack open. She turns away from the patio doors, spooked. And that's when it comes to her, just like that. The news story she watched yesterday, the road traffic accident, it happens tonight, is on tomorrow's news. She can use it. She can use it to convince the person she needs to confide in the most. If she can convince Kelly, maybe it will break the cycle, break the time loop, and she'll wake up on tomorrow. "I'll be in touch," she tells Pauline. "Don't worry, it's nothing, probably," she adds, wondering why she has always felt the need to do that, to be easygoing, not to worry people, to be good. "Hope so," Pauline says. Kelly wanders into the kitchen, much later, after 10 at night. "What?" Kelly says curiously, catching her expression. "What's up?" "Will you come somewhere with me?" she says. "Now?" he asks. He looks at her for a beat. "You in full mad town," he says with a small, wry smile. After they first met and went travelling around the UK in a little camper van, they lived for years in the Lancashire countryside, just the three of them, in a little white house with a grey slate roof at the bottom of a valley that caught the mist in the winter like a candy floss hat. Jen's favourite ever house. Kelly had coined this term back then, when she used to come home and download her entire working day to him. She'd never needed anybody else. "Totally," she says. "Come on then, we can walk." Their gazes meet, and Jem wonders what she might be about to set in motion, wonders whether the future is different now. Wonders if, together, they might make it worse, if there is some alternative future unspooling as she stands here, motionless, in her kitchen, where Todd himself is murdered, where he runs away, where he attacks more than one person. Jen pushes open the front door. She's excited for it, to present him with actual, tangible proof. The night air is chilly and damp, the same as it was on that first night. It smells of the mildew of autumn. "I have something to say to you, and I know how you're going to react because I've already told you," she says. Kelly's hand is warm in hers. The road is slick with rain. Jen's getting better at this explanation. "Is this about work?" Kelly is used to Jen asking him about work, theorising at him, though mostly all he does is listen. Just last week she asked him about Mr. Mahoney, who wanted to give his ex-wife his entire pension just to save the battle. Kelly had shrugged and said avoiding pain was priceless to some. "No." And there in the darkness she tells him everything, in total detail, again. She tells him about the first time, and then the day before it, and then the day before that. He listens, his eyes on her, the way he always has. He doesn't speak for a few moments after she's finished, just leans there against the road sign, close to where the accident is due to happen, appearing to be lost in thought. Eventually, he seems to come to a conclusion and says, "Would you believe this if it were me?" "No," he barks out a laugh. "Right. I promise," she says, "on everything we stand for, all our history, that I am telling you the truth. Todd murders somebody this Saturday late, and I'm moving back in time to stop it." Kelly is silent for a minute. It begins to drizzle again. He pushes his hair off his forehead as it gets wet. "Why are we here?" "For me to prove it to you. A car's going to come along here soon," she says, gesturing to the dark, quiet street. "It'll lose control and flip onto its side. It was just on the news last night. My tomorrow. The owner escapes, totally unharmed. It's a black Audi. It flips over there. It won't go near us." Kelly rubs a hand along his jaw. "Okay," he says again, dismissive, confused. Together they lean back on the road sign, side by side. Just as she is beginning to think the car won't come, it does. Jen hears it first, a distant, speeding rumble. Here it is. Kelly looks at her. The rain has intensified. His hair begins to drip. And then it rounds the corner. A black Audi, fast, out of control. The driver, clearly reckless, drunk, both. Its engine sounds like gunfire as it passes them. Kelly watches it, his eyes fixed on it, his expression inscrutable. Kelly pulls his hood up with one hand against the downpour just as the car flips. A metallic crunch and skid, the horn goes. Then nothing. A beat of silence while the car smokes. Then the owner emerges, wide-eyed. He's maybe 50, ambles across the road to them. "You're lucky to be out of that," Jen says. Kelly's eyes are back on her. Disbelief, but also a weird kind of panic, seems to radiate from him. "I know," the man says to Jen. He pats his legs like he's unable to believe that he's really fine. Kelly shakes his head. "I don't understand this." A neighbour is about to come out to offer help, Jen commentates. Kelly waits, saying nothing, one foot against the leg of the street, arms folded. A door slams somewhere. "I've called an ambulance," a voice says a few houses down. "Do you believe me yet?" she says to Kelly. "I can't think of any other explanation," he says after a few seconds. "But this is mental." "I know that. Of course I know that." She squares herself in front of him so she can look directly into his eyes. "But I promise, I promise, I promise, I promise it's true." Kelly makes a gesture down the street and they walk, but not home. They stroll aimlessly together in the rain. Jen thinks he might believe her, truly. And won't that do something, surely? If Todd's other parent believes it? Maybe Kelly will wake up with her yesterday for him too. It's a long shot, but she has to try it. "This is completely batshit," he says. His eyes catch the overhead lights as they move. There is no way you could have known about that car, is there? She can see him trying to work it out. No. I mean, literally, no. I can't see how... His breath mists up the air in front of him. I just don't... I know. They take a left, then walk down an alleyway past their favourite Indian takeaway, then start a slow loop back towards home. Eventually, he takes her hand in his. If it's true, it must be horrible, he says. That if. Jen loves it. It is a small step, a small concession from husband to wife. It is horrible, she says thickly. As she thinks over the past few days of panic and alienation, her eyes moisten and a tear tracks its way down her cheek. She stares at their feet as they walk the streets in perfect sync. Kelly must be watching her because he stops and wipes the tear away with a thumb. I'll try, he says simply, softly to her. I'll try to believe you. When they get in, he pulls up a stool at the breakfast bar, sitting at it with his knees spread, his elbows on the counter, his eyes on her, brows raised. Do you have a theory on this Joseph? Kelly says. Henry VIII jumps onto the kitchen island, and Jen gathers him to her, his fur soft, his body so fat and yielding, and puts her hands around him like cupping a bowl. She's so glad to be here, with Kelly, sharing the same spot in the universe together, confiding in him. I mean, no, but the night Todd stabbed him, it's like he sees this Joseph, then he just panics and does it. So he's afraid of him. Yes, Jen says, that's exactly it. She looks at her husband. So you believe me? Maybe I'm humouring you, he says languidly, but she doesn't think so. Look, I made these notes, she says, jumping up and grabbing the notepad. Kelly joins her on the sofa in their kitchen. They're pretty scant. Kelly looks at the page, then laughs, a tiny exhale of a sound. Oh dear, these are very scant. Stop it or I won't tell you the lottery numbers, Jen says. And it's so nice to laugh about it. It's so nice to be back here in their easy dynamic. Oh, yeah, all right, look, let's write down every possible reason he could have for doing this, even the mad ones. Self-defense, loss of control, conspiracy, Jen says, working as a hitman. This isn't James Bond. Oh, all right, cross that one out. Kelly laughs as he scratches a line through Hitman. Aliens? Stop it, Jen says through laughter. They make more and more and more lists as the night draws on. All his friends, all his acquaintances that she could speak to. On the dimly lit sofa, Jen's body sags. She leans into Kelly, whose arm immediately snakes around her. When will you, I don't know, go? When I sleep. So let's stay up. Tried that one. She stays there, listening to his breathing slow. She can feel hers slowing too, but she's happy to go today. She's happy she's got today with him. What would you do? She asks, turning to look at him. Kelly folds his lips in on themselves, an expression on his face that Jen can't read. You sure you want to know that? Of course I do, she says, though for just a second she wonders if she really does. Kelly's sense of humour can be dark, but just sometimes his very core self can seem this way too. If Jen had to describe it, she'd say she expects the best of people and Kelly expects the worst. I'd kill him, he says softly. Joseph, Jen says, her jaw slack. Yeah. He pulls his eyes away from whatever he's looking at and meets her gaze. Yeah, I'd kill him myself, this Joseph, if I could get away with it. So that Todd couldn't, she says in almost a whisper. Exactly. She shivers, totally chilled by this incisive thought, this edge her husband sometimes exhibits. But could you? Kelly shrugs, looking out at the dark garden. He doesn't intend to answer this question, Jen can tell. So, tomorrow, he murmurs, pulling her back close to him against his body. It'll be yesterday for you, tomorrow for me. That's right, she says sadly, but thinking privately that maybe it won't be, that maybe telling him has avoided that fate somehow. Kelly's quiet. He's falling asleep. Jen's blinks get longer. They are here tonight, together, even if they might part again tomorrow, like two passengers on two trains going in opposite directions. Day minus 4, 0900. 4 days back, and worse, the notebook is blank. Jen lets a scream of frustration out in the kitchen. Of course it is, of course it fucking is, because she hasn't written in it yet, because she's in the past. Kelly walks into the kitchen, biting into an apple. God, he says, wincing, these are tart. Here, try, it's like eating a lemon. He holds it out to her, his arm extended, his eyes happy, crinkled. Do you remember our walk last night? She asks him desperately. Huh? He says through a mouthful. What? He clearly doesn't. Telling him achieved nothing. Just 12 hours ago, they sat here together and made a plan. The car crash, the conviction on his features as he turned to her, all gone, consigned not to the past, but to the future. Never mind. You all right? You look like shit, he says. Ah, married life, so romantic. But inside, her mind is racing. If the notebook is blank, then of course the phone calls and emails to Andy Vertizzi haven't yet been made either. She checks her sent items. Nothing. Of course. No wonder he hasn't replied. It is so hard to get used to a life lived backwards. Even when she thinks she understands it, she doesn't. It trips her up. She needs to leave, get away from this Kelly who knows nothing about tomorrow and the next day and everything that follows. She needs to get away from disappearing notebooks and knives in school bags and from the scene of the crime that stands silently waiting. She needs to go to work, back to Rakesh and to Andy Vertizzi too. 10 o'clock in the morning, a sweet black coffee, her desk and Rakesh. He has stood here thousands of times over the years, often swings by early and complains that he doesn't want to start work. That was the foundation they built their friendship on, moaning. Can you try to contact Andy for me, Jen says to Rakesh now. She has just told Rakesh again what's happening to her. Jen rushed through her explanation to Rakesh, appearing inauthentic and haphazard. She's told it so many times, she has become tired of the tragedy of it, like somebody who's seen so much death and destruction that they are immune. Still, Rakesh seemed to believe that she really thinks this is happening to her, the same way he did last time. Passively, serious, perhaps internally diagnosing her with something, but not saying what. I can't get hold of him, and I need to. Jen says sincerely but urgently. She needs to speak to Andy today. It's all she has. Rakesh steeples his fingers together in that way he does. I'm sure I've never told you about Andy, he says with a small smile. You do, in a few days. I see, Rakesh says, looking at her directly, his brown eyes on hers. He's wearing a sweater vest today, in purple, and holding a coffee. The rectangular outline of a box of cigarettes is visible in his trouser pocket. Some things don't change. Jen can't help but smile back at him. Please call him. He's nearby, isn't he? John Moores? I can go to his office, whatever. What's it worth? Rakesh leans on the doorframe. Oh, are we negotiating? Always. I'll do your cost schedule on Blakemore. God! Deal, he says immediately. You're so easy. I would have done it for a potato. And I'll take your cigarette so you can get back on the wagon, she points to his pocket. He blinks, then pulls them out. Wow, okay, I see. He retreats back down the corridor. I'll call him now. He raises a hand, a parting gesture. Let you know. Thank you, Jen says, though she doesn't think he can still hear her. She rests her elbows on the desk she's worked at for the past 2 decades, feeling momentarily relieved to have instructed an expert. The sunlight warms her back. She'd forgotten this little warm spell. a few days in October that felt for a second just like summer. Andy says he will come to Liverpool city centre in 2 hours' time. Jen, like a mug, does Rakesh's cost schedule for him. Jen and Andy arrange to meet in a cafe that Jen likes. It is unpretentious, cheap, the coffee good and strong. She finds romance in the retro quality it has. Tea that costs pence, not pounds. Ham sandwiches on the menu. Torn vinyl benches to sit on. As she walks there, weaving between shoppers and past off-key buskers, all the way she's ineffectually mothered Todd, crowd into her mind. Feeding him too much so he slept more. Upending the bottle while watching daytime television. Bored, no eye contact. That time she shouted in frustration when he wouldn't nap. How early she went back to work because her father put pressure on her, enrolling Todd in nursery so young, too young. Has she planted these seeds here? Was she a shit mother or just a human? She doesn't know. Andy is already there at a formica-covered table. Jen recognises him from his LinkedIn photo instantly. About Rakesh's age, unruly hair woven black and grey. A T-shirt that says Franny and Zooey on it. J.D. Salinger, is that? Thanks for seeing me, Jen says, quickly taking a seat opposite him. He's already ordered two black coffees. A miniature silver milk jug sits on the table, which he gestures wordlessly to. Neither of them uses it. Pleasure, Andy says, though it doesn't sound like it. He sounds jaded, like how she gets when pushed into giving free legal advice at parties. It's fair enough. This must be unorthodox, she says, adding sugar to her coffee. You know, he says, sitting back with a small shrug. He has just a trace of an American accent. Yes. He makes a lattice with his hands and rests his face on it, just looking at her. But Rakesh is a good friend. Well, I won't keep you long, she says, though she doesn't mean it. She wants him to sit with her all day, ideally into yesterday. Andy raises his eyebrows, not saying anything. He sips his coffee, then replaces it on the table, calm hazel eyes looking at her. He motions wordlessly, the kind of gesture you'd make when letting somebody through a door. Go ahead, he says crisply. Jen begins to speak. She tells him everything, every last piece. She talks fast, gesticulating, insane amounts of detail, every last part. Pumpkins, naked husbands, Cutting and Sewing Limited, the knife, how she tried to stay up, the car accident, Cleo, the lot. A waitress silently fills their coffees up from a steaming percolator, and Andy thanks her, but only with his eyes and a small smile. He doesn't interrupt Jen once. I think that's everything, she says when she has finished. Steam dances around the overhead fluorescent lights. The cafe is near empty on this day, whatever day it is, in the mid-morning, midweek. Jen is so tired, suddenly, with somebody else temporarily in charge, she thinks she could sleep right here at the table. She wonders what would happen if she did. I don't need to ask you if you believe you are telling me the truth, Andy says after what looks like a moment's consideration. The somewhat passive-aggressive, if you believe, rattles Jen. The parlance of doctors, legal opponents, passive-aggressive relatives, slimming world leaders. I do, she says, for what it's worth. She rubs at her eyes for a minute, trying to think. Come on, she tells herself. You're a smart woman. This isn't so hard. It's time as you know it, only backwards. You win an award in 2 days, she says, thinking of the story she saw about him when he hadn't answered her, for your work on black holes. When she opens her eyes, Andy has paused, his coffee halfway to his mouth, the styrofoam cup made elliptical by the pressure of his grip. His mouth is open, his eyes on hers. The Penny Jameson? I think so, I saw it while Googling you. I win? Jen feels a petty, triumphant little spark light within her, there. You do. That award is embargoed. I know I'm shortlisted, but nobody else does. It isn't... He gets his phone out and types quietly for a second, then replaces it face down on the table. That information is not in the public domain. Well, I'm glad. All right then, Jen, he says. You have my attention.
Good.
How interesting. Andy sucks his bottom lip into his mouth. He drums his fingers on the back of his phone. So, is it scientifically possible? She asks him. He spreads his hands wide, then repositions them around his cup. We don't know, he says. Science is much more of an art than you'd think. What you say violates Einstein's law of general relativity. But who's to say his theorem should control our life? Time travel isn't proven to be impossible, he says. If you can get above the speed of light... Yes, a gravitational force 1,000 times my body weight, right?
Exactly.
But I didn't feel anything like that. Can I ask, do you think I went forwards, too, in time? So, somewhere, I'm living the life where Todd was arrested.
You think there may be more than one of you?
I guess so.
Hang on.
He takes the knife from the cutlery pot sitting next to them. Can you use this?
Use it.
A tiny paper cut. He leaves the rest implicit. Jen swallows.
I see.
Okay. She takes the knife and makes, quite honestly, the most pathetic shallow cut along the side of her finger, barely a scour.
Deeper, he says.
Jen directs the knife further into her cut. A bead of blood escapes.
Okay, she says, blotting it with a tissue.
Okay?
She looks down at the wound, a centimetre long.
If that cut isn't there tomorrow, I'd say you're waking up in yesterday's body each day. You move from Monday to Sunday to Saturday.
Rather than time travelling.
Right. Tell me. He sits forward. Did you experience any kind of compressing sensation when this happened, or only the déjà vu?
Only the déjà vu.
How curious. The panic you felt for your son, do you think it caused that feeling?
I don't know, Jen says softly, almost to herself. It's mad. It's so mad. I don't understand it. I haven't yet telephoned you. I do. Later in the week, I leave loads of messages.
It seems to me, Andy says, finishing his coffee, that you do actually already understand the rules of the universe you are unwillingly in.
It doesn't feel like it, she says, and he allows a smile to escape again.
It's theoretically possible for you to have somehow created such a force that you are stuck in a closed time-like curve.
Theoretically possible, right. So how do I get out of it?
Physics aside, the obvious answer would be that you will reach the inception of the crime, wouldn't it? Go back to what made Todd commit the crime.
And then what, if you had to guess?
She raises her hands in a gesture of non-confrontation.
Nothing at stake, just a guess. What do you think would happen?
Andy bites his bottom lip, eyes to the table, then looks at her.
You would stop the crime from happening.
God, I so hope so, Jen says, her eyes wet.
Can I ask a question that might seem facetious? Andy says.
The air seems to quieten around them as Andy's gaze meets hers.
Why do you think this is happening to you?
Jen hesitates, about to say, indeed facetiously, that she doesn't know. That is why she's forced him to meet her. But something stops her.
She thinks about time loops, about the butterfly effect, changing one tiny thing.
I wonder if I, alone, know something that can stop the murder, Jen says, deep in my subconscious.
Knowledge, Andy says, nodding. This isn't time travel or science or maths. Isn't this just...
You have the knowledge and the love to stop a crime.
Jen thinks about the knife she found in Todd's bag and about Ishi Road North.
Like, on every day I have relived so far, I've learned something by doing something different, following someone or witnessing something I hadn't the first time, even just paying more attention to small things.
Andy fiddles with his empty cup on the table, turning his mouth down, still thinking, eyes on the windows behind Jen. Well, then, it is fair to say that each day you're landing in is somehow significant to the crime.
Maybe, yes.
So, as you go backwards, maybe you'll skip a day. Maybe you'll skip a week.
Perhaps.
Then I should be looking for clues on each one.
Yeah, maybe, he says simply.
I hope you'd, you know, give me a hack to get out. I don't know, 2 sticks of dynamite and a code or something.
Dynamite, Andy says with a laugh. He rises to his feet and reaches out to shake her hand. Her eyes close as he does it, just for a second.
It's real. His hand is real. She is real.
Until we meet again, she says, opening her eyes.
Until then, Andy says.
Jen leaves the cafe after him, deep, deep in thought about what it might all mean. She calls Todd, wanting to know where he is, wanting to know if there is something he is doing that she missed the first time she lived this day, feeling a renewed kind of vigour for working out how to change things, for saving him.
All right, he answers.
It's quiet in the background. Jen, caught in a Liverpool wind tunnel, turns her body away from the gust.
Just wondering where you are, she says to him.
Online, he says, and Jen can't help but smile. At just him. Lovely him.
Online? In our house, she says. I have a free period, so I am in our house, on our VPN, on my bed, in Crosby, Merseyside, UK, he says, a laugh in his voice.
She looks at the sky and thinks, well, I'll see. She might see August before November, but she'll get to the beginning of the problem, whatever that is. The moon is out, an early lunchtime moon, hanging above both of them, whichever versions of themselves they are. She in the past, and Todd undergoing whatever changes that lead him to killing somebody in 4 days' time.
I'll be home soon, she says.
Where are you?
The universe, she says, and he laughs, a noise so perfect to her, it may as well be music.
Jen is back at Ishi Road North, hoping to find Cleo. She assumes she doesn't live with her uncle, but perhaps he can direct her to Cleo's address. Jen believes the key rests with Cleo. Todd met her a couple of months ago, as far as Jen knows, but you can add at least a few weeks for teenage secrecy. It can't be a coincidence that that is when it began, along with his friendship with Connor. It being an amorphous, hard-to-describe change. Sullenness, secrecy, that strange pallor he has at times. And so here she is, knocking. Almost immediately, a female form appears in the frosted glass. Jen's heart rises up in her chest. The door opens, and Jen can't help but marvel at Cleo's beauty, that short, chic fringe, her close-together eyes. Her hair is snarled, undone, but it looks good for it, rather than the insane way Jen would look if she tried the same.
Hi, Jen says.
Cleo glances over her shoulder, a quick, automatic move, but Jen spots it and wonders what it means.
Todd's mum, Jen says, realizing after a second's hesitation that although Jen has met Cleo, Cleo has not met Jen.
Oh, Cleo says, her striking features slackening in surprise.
I just wondered, Jen says. She glances down.
Cleo has stepped back slightly, not to let Jen in, but as if she is about to close the door. Jen thinks of her open, curious expression the first time she saw her, when she was in those ripped jeans at the end of this same hallway. Cleo's face now, when Todd isn't here, is totally different.
I just wondered if we might have a bit of a chat.
She gestures to Cleo. It's nothing to do with you, really. I'm fine with your relationship. Can I come in, just for a sec?
Is this where you live? She gabbles.
Look, I can't, Cleo says. Jen looks around the hallway. Cleo's coat is hanging up, thrown over the door to the cupboard that Ezra closed. Over the coat is a Chanel handbag, Jen thinks a real one. They're worth at least £5,000, aren't they? How can she afford one, unless it's a fake?
It's nothing bad, Jen says, her eyes still on that bag. Cleo's brows knit together. Her mouth begins to scrunch up into a delicate kind of apology. I really, she says, her hands wringing together. She takes another step back. I'm so, so sorry. I just really can't. You can't what? Jen says, totally bewildered. I really can't talk about it with you. Talk about what? Jen says, suddenly remembering that Kelly thought they'd broken up. You haven't fallen out. Something seems to pass over Cleo's features that Jen can't name. Some understanding, but Jen isn't privy to what. Please explain, she adds pathetically. We broke up, but then we got back together yesterday. It's complicated. How? Cleo shrinks back from Jen, drawing her arms around her stomach, folding in on herself like somebody frail or feeling ill. Sorry, she says, barely audibly, taking another step back. I'll see you soon, okay? She closes the door, leaving Jen there alone. It latches with a soft click, and through the frosted glass, Jen watches Cleo retreat. She turns to leave. As she does so, a police car circles past, very, very slowly. It's the pace of it that makes Jen look up at it. The windows are up, the driver looking straight ahead. The passenger, who Jen is sure is the handsome police officer who arrests Todd, looking straight at her. As she walks to her car, defeated by Cleo's reaction, bewildered by the mystery facing her, the car circles back, going the other way. Jen thinks about what Andy said as she drives away, about her subconscious, about what she knows, about things she might have seen and dismissed as insignificant, and about what she's here to do. There's nothing else for it, she thinks as she drives away. She's got to ask her son. I have something I want to run by you, Jen says conversationally, walking to the corner shop with Todd. He will buy a Snickers. Last time she bought a bottle of wine, but she's not in the mood tonight. They take this walk often. Todd, because of his insatiable teenage appetite, and, well, the same for Jen, actually. There will be somebody in the corner shop wearing a trilby, and this trilby is Jen's trump card. Unpredictable, vivid, true. She is glad she has remembered it. She can use it to convince Todd, and then, if nothing else, find out what he would do in this situation. Her brainiac son. Shoot, Todd says easily. They turn down a side street. The night air smells of other people's dinners, something Jen finds endlessly nostalgic, reminding her of holidays with her parents to campsites when she was little. She will always remember the distant orange lights of other static caravans, the chink of cutlery, the swirling smoke of barbecues. God, she misses her father. Her mother too, she guesses, though she hardly remembers her. What would you do if you could time travel? Would you go forwards or back? Jen says, and he looks at her in surprise. Why? He asks. Typically, before she can answer, he does. I'd go back, he says, his breath blowing smoke rings out into the night air. How come? So I could tell past me some stuff, he smiles, a private smile at the pavement. Jen laughs softly, inscrutable Jen's ears. Then he says, I'd just email myself, from past me to future me, sent on a timer. You can do that on some sites. Email yourself? Yeah, you know, find out whose stocks and shares are going to go through the roof, then go back in time, do a timed email from me to me saying, in September 2006 or whatever, buy shares in Apple. I'd just email myself. Well, it's something to try. An email sent, timed to be received at 1 o'clock in the morning, on the day it happens, on the 29th. Heading into the 30th, she will write it so it contains instructions. Get outside. Stop a murder. Surely if she had advance warning, she could physically stop Todd. You're so smart. Why, thank you. You might wonder why I'm asking, she says. Not really, he says cheerfully. She begins to explain travelling backwards, omitting the crime for now. She is glancing at him all the time as they walk and talk. If she had to predict his response, she would say he will need no convincing. She knows him. She knows him. He, still a kid in so many ways, believes unquestioningly in time loops, in time travel, in science and philosophy and cool maths and exceptional things happening in his life, which he still, in his young mind, believes to be extraordinary. Todd says nothing for a few seconds, staring at his trainers as they walk through the cold, his features wrinkled. He raises an eyebrow to her. "Are you for real?" he asks. "Completely, totally." "You've seen the future?"
"I have."
"All right then, Mother. So what happens?" he says jovially, and she's pretty sure he thinks she's joking. "Meteors? The next pandemic? What?"
Jen says nothing, debating how honest to be. He looks at her and catches her expression.
"You're not actually serious."
"I really, really am. You're about to buy a Snickers. There will be someone in the corner shop wearing a Trilby."
"Okay," he nods just once. "A time loop, a Trilby, you're on."
Jen smiles at him, unsurprised he's isolated the element of the future that he cannot control, that belongs to someone else, the hat. This is exactly what she thought he would do. He is a much easier person to convince than Kelly.
"Do you know why?" he says.
"Something happens in 4 days that I think I need to stop."
"What?"
he says again. It's not good, Todd. In 4 days' time, you kill someone," she says. This time it's like lighting a bonfire, a tiny spark and then a rush. Todd's head snaps up to look at her. Jen goes as hot as if she's standing right by it. What if she makes this happen by telling him? Surely the knowledge that you can kill is damaging to a person. No, she has decided to do this and she needs to see it through. He can take it, her son. He likes facts. He likes people to be straight with him. He doesn't speak for over a minute.
"Who?"
he says, the same question he asked the last time. "He was a stranger to me. You seem to know him." He doesn't react. They reach the lit-up shop next door to a Chinese takeaway, and they stand outside it. Eventually, his eyes meet hers. She's surprised to see that they're wet. Just the slightest damp covering. It could be nothing. It could just be the lights of the shops, the cold air.
"Well, I'd never kill anyone," he says, not making eye contact with her.
She spreads her arms wide.
"But you do. He's called Joseph Jones." Her eyes are wet too now.
Todd runs his gaze over her face, holds a finger up and goes into the shop. He's right, of course. He wouldn't kill someone unless he had no other choice. She knows him. He would ameliorate, confess. He would do a whole long list of things before killing. This is perhaps the most useful piece of information Jen has landed on. Seconds later, he's out, and his body language has completely changed. It's infinitesimal, as though somebody momentarily pressed pause on his movements, then started him up again, only a stutter.
"Trilby," he says, "a beat.
Present and correct.
So you believe me now?
You saw the Trilby from down the street, I assume."
"I didn't. Todd, you know that I didn't."
"I would never kill someone. Never, never, never." His eyes look up to the heavens, and Jen is sure, as sure as she can be, that she sees disappointment but also understanding cross his features, like somebody who's been told something, like somebody who's been told the ending when they're right at the beginning. She is blindsided by his reaction. It isn't time travel that has outsmarted her. It is parenting. He turns away from her. Jen knows him. He closed up as soon as she told him the details.
"Why'd you break up with Cleo?"
"None of your business. Back together now, anyway."
Jen sighs. They walk back in stony silence.
Kelly answers the door before Jen can get out a key. Todd brushes past him without speaking to him, going upstairs. Interestingly, he doesn't tell Kelly what Jen just told him. Ordinarily, she's sure they would take the piss together. Kelly is cooking a pie. When she sits down at the breakfast bar in the kitchen, he pours the sauce into the pastry-lined dish and opens the oven. The heat and the steam from the oven shimmer so violently that he seems to disappear right in front of her. That night, Jen Googles how to send a timed email and then fires it off, hopeful, into the ether. As she falls asleep, she prays it works. She prays a future her, somewhere, stops the crime and breaks the time loop.
Day minus 8, 0800. The email didn't work. The cut she made with the knife is gone. And for the first time, Jen has skipped back more than one day. She's moved 4 days. It is the 21st. She sits up in bed and thinks about Andy. It seems he was right. Or perhaps it's speeding up and soon she will leap back years at a time and then cease to exist entirely. No, don't think this way. Concentrate on Todd. As if on cue, she hears him slam his bedroom door. "Where are you going?" she calls out to him. She hears him ascend the stairs to the top floor where Jen and Kelly's bedroom is, and then he appears, a wide smile across his face. He looks full of the lols, as he would say. "Dad is making me come running," he says. "Pray for me." "You're in my thoughts," Jen says, as she listens to them go. She's glad to see him like this, pink-cheeked and happy. Within minutes, still in her dressing gown, she's back in Todd's room, searching his desk drawers again, the ones in his bedside tables, under his mattress, under his bed. As she searches, she recites to herself what she knows. Todd meets Cleo in late summer. Kelly said, "He's still seeing Cleo? I thought he said he wasn't, in the days before the crime." Todd confirmed a few days earlier that they broke up and got back together. Plates, cups, reams and reams of school stuff printed from the internet. Behind the wardrobe, a piece of paper about astrophysics. "Cleo is frightened to speak to me," she adds, thinking it must be significant. "Plus, that weird circling police car." Finally, 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 after 20 minutes, she finds something that feels a lot more tangible than listening to her own ramblings. It's on top of his wardrobe, right at the back, but not covered in dust, so not old. It is a small grey oblong bundle held together by an elastic band. Jen climbs down from his desk chair and holds it in the flat of her hand. Drugs. She thinks it might be drugs. Her hands shake as she undoes the elastic, then peels open the bubble wrap. It isn't drugs. The package contains 3 items. A Merseyside police badge, not the full ID, just the leather wallet with the Merseyside crest on it. On it is embroidered a number and a name. Ryan Hiles, 2648. Jen fingers it. It's cool in her hands. She holds it up to the light. How does a teenage boy come to have a police badge? She doesn't chase that thought down the alley it wants to go down, though it's obvious that it's nothing good. Next, folded into 4 neat squares, is a dog-eared A4 poster with a photograph of a baby on it, maybe 4 months old. Above him or her is written "Missing" in red blocky letters. There is a pinhole in the corner. Jen blinks in shock. Missing. Missing babies? Police IDs? What is this dark world Todd's been plunged into? The final item is what looks like a pay-as-you-go phone. It's off. Jen's finger trembles as she presses the on button and watches it spring to life, its screen a neon green. No passcode. It's an old-style flip phone, not a smartphone. It was clearly never meant to be discovered. She looks at the contacts. There are 3. Joseph Jones, Ezra Michaels, and somebody called Nicola Williams. She goes to the text messages, listening out for Todd and Kelly. Times for meetings with Joseph and Ezra. 11 p.m. here, 9 a.m. there. But with Nicola, it's different. Burner phone, 15th of the 10th. "Nice to chat. See you on the 16th? Nicola W. 15th of the 10th. I can be there. Burner phone, 15th of the 10th. Happy to help tomorrow? Nicola W. 15th of the 10th. Happy to help. Burner phone, 17th of the 10th. Call me. Nicola W. 17th of the 10th. P.S. It's in place, but see you tonight. Nicola W. 17th of the 10th. Nice to meet. Happy to do it, but you need to work for it, given what's happened. Burner phone, 17th of the 10th. Yep, understood.
Nicola W., 17th of the 10th. Get back in there.
Burnaphone, 17th of the 10th.
Baby or no baby?
Nicola W., 18th of the 10th.
All in place. When we have enough, we can move in.
Jen stares at them. A gold mine. Actual date-stamped messages arranging something. Jen must be able to work out what. She must be able to follow her son on these days to insert herself into proceedings. She turns the rest of the items over, looking for more, but there's nothing. She sits back on Todd's desk chair. Catastrophes crowd into Jen's mind. Dead policemen, dead kids, kidnaps, ransoms. Is he some sort of foot soldier? A minion sent to undertake a gang's bidding? She stands on the chair and puts the bundle back exactly where it was, then sits in her son's ransacked bedroom. Her knees tremble. She watches them, shivering just slightly, thinking that it's all her fault. It must be. Nicola Williams, why is that name familiar to her? She looks up Joseph, Cleo, Ezra and Nicola on Facebook. All are there except Nicola, and all three are friends with the other. Joseph's profile is new, but he looks like a perfectly ordinary man, an interest in horse racing and opinions on Brexit. Ezra's is more established, his profile pictures dating back 10 years, but it's otherwise locked. She tidies up, then makes Todd's bed, her hand smoothing over his pillow, but it's lumpy, something underneath it. She never checked there. Checked only under the mattress, like in the movies. She reaches for the bulge, hoping to find information, but actually, she just finds Science Bear. The teddy Todd's had since he was 2, the one who holds a blue fluffy Bunsen burner and a test tube. He must still sleep with it. Her heart cracks for him, here in his bedroom, thinking of that night with the norovirus and wiping his mouth with that hot flannel, and the other night, the one with the murder, her son, the half-child, half-man. Crosby Police Station foyer looks the same as it did that first night, tired, smelling of canteen dinners and coffee. Jen arrives at 6, looking for Ryan Hiles. It seems to her that this is the next logical step. Todd and Kelly think she's at the supermarket. She is told to wait, and she sits on one of the metal chairs, staring at the white door to the left of the reception desk. At the end of a long corridor behind it, she can see a tall, slim police officer moving around on the phone, laughing at something, pacing slowly this way and that. The receptionist is blonde. She has chapped lips, the line between skin and mouth blurred and sore-looking, in that way it is when people have a habit of wetting their lips. The automatic doors open, but nobody comes in. The receptionist ignores the doors. She's typing quickly, her gaze not moving from the screen. It's twilight outside. To anybody else, it looks like a normal day at 6 o'clock in October. Wood smoke comes in on the breeze as the glitchy automatic doors open and close for nobody again. Jen folds her hands in her lap and thinks about normal life, the continuity of one day following another. She stares at the doors sliding open, hesitating and then closing, and tries not to wonder if Todd is proceeding somewhere in the future without her, facing life in prison. Not even the best lawyer would be able to get him off. "Can I just take your name?" the receptionist says. She seems content to conduct this conversation across the foyer. "Alison," Jen says, not yet ready to reveal her identity without knowing where Ryan Hiles is and why Todd has his badge. The last thing she wants to do is make things worse for Todd in the future. "Alison Bland," she invents. "Okay, and what's the... I'm looking for a police officer. I have his name and badge number." "Why is it you want to see him?" The receptionist dials a number on the desk phone. Jen doesn't say she has the badge itself, doesn't want to hand over evidence, link Todd's fingerprints to something heinous, to something else heinous. "I just want to speak to him." "Sorry, we can't have civilians coming in to give names and ask to speak to coppers," the receptionist says. It isn't a bad thing, I just want to talk to him." "We really can't do that. Do you need to report a crime?" "I mean," Jen says, she goes to say no, but then hesitates. Maybe the police can help her. Just because the murder hasn't happened yet doesn't mean that no crimes at all have been committed. The knife.
Buying a knife is a crime. It's a gamble, he might not yet have bought it, but it's one she is prepared to take. If Todd is investigated for something smaller, perhaps that would stop the larger crime. Something ignites in Jen. All she needs is change, to blow out one match in a whole line of them, to keep a domino standing that would otherwise fall, and then perhaps she will wake up and it will be tomorrow. Yes, she says to the receptionist, obvious surprise. Yes, I'd like to report a crime. 25 minutes later, Jen is in a meeting room with a police officer. He's young, with pale blue eyes like a wolf. Each time they meet hers, Jen is struck by how unusual they are. A dark blue rim, light blue pools in the centre, tiny pupils. Something about the colour makes them look vacant. He's freshly shaven, his uniform a little too big for him. Right, tell me, he says. They have 2 white plastic cups of water in front of them. The room smells of photocopier toner and stale coffee. The setting seems so mundane for the reaction Jen hopes to set off. I'll just keep a note, he adds. She doesn't want this. A young officer who takes meticulous notes and won't answer questions. Jen wants a maverick, someone who goes off the record, who has a dead wife and an alcohol problem, someone who can help her. I'm pretty sure my son is involved in something, she says, simply. She skims over the alias she gave, hoping he won't question this, and goes to the heart of the matter. His name is Todd Brotherhood. And that's when it happens. Recognition. Jen is sure of it. It passes across his features like a ghost. What makes you say he's involved in something? She tells the officer about the cutting and sewing business, about her son meeting Joseph Jones, and about the knife. She hopes that if Todd has armed himself already, they will find that weapon, arrest him, and stop the crime. The police officer's pen stalls just slightly at the mention of the knife. His iced eyes flick to hers, the colour of a gas fire on low, then back down again. Jen can feel it in the air, the change, even in here. She has lit the touch paper, the butterfly has flapped its wings. Right, where is the knife? How do you know he's bought one? I'm not sure right now, but I have seen it in his school bag once, she says, omitting that this happens in the future. Has he ever left the house with it? I assume so. Okay then, the officer says, upending the pen. All right, looks like we need to speak to your son. Today? Jen asks. The policeman finishes writing and looks at her. He glances at the clock on the wall. We'll make inquiries with Todd. She shivers there in the warm police interviewing room. What if there is some unintended consequence of this action she's just taken? Maybe Joseph Jones should die if he's got something to do with something terrible, and she only needs to help Todd get away with it. How is she supposed to know which it is? Okay, well, I can go and get Todd for you, she says, wondering quite how she's coming across. How strange it must sound. Even now, in this chaos, Jen still worries about being judged as a parent. Just your address is enough, the officer says. He stands up and extends the flat of his palm towards the door. An instant dismissal. Just arrest him, please arrest him, so he can't do anything more, Jen thinks. Nothing you can do today, she probes again. She needs him taken in tonight before she sleeps, if she has even a chance of stopping the crime. Tomorrow doesn't exist, not to her, anyway. The policeman pauses, looking at his feet, that palm still extended. I'll try my best. You know, usually young men carry knives because of gangs. I know, Jen whispers. We'll talk to your son, but in order to get kids out of this, you have to work out the why. I'm trying, Jen says. She stops just there, on the threshold of the meeting room, then decides to just ask, have any babies gone missing in the area recently? Sorry, the officer says. Missing babies? Yes, recently. I can't discuss other cases, he says, giving nothing away. She leaves then, and as she exits through the glass doors etched with a finely threaded grid and steps outside, she smells it. Not what she was expecting. Petrichor. Rain on pavements. Summer's coming back. That smell, that intangible smell. Lawns being mowed, cow parsley, hot packed earth, always reminds her of the house they had in the valley, the little white bungalow, how happy they were there, away from the city, before. On the way home, she thinks about Ryan Hiles and about the missing baby. She can still see the poster. There is something she recognizes about that baby, an instinctive familiarity, as though they may be a distant relative, someone she now knows as an adult, someone she has perhaps met, but she can't think. Jen has never been good with babies. She got pregnant with Todd accidentally, only 8 months after she met Kelly. It was a shock, but he used to joke they'd had a decade's worth of sex in that year, which is true. The little camper van and their clothes strewn across the floor are her only memories of that time. His hips against hers, how he'd said to her wryly one night that everybody would be able to see their van rocking, how she didn't care. They'd been in their early 20s. She'd been on the pill and most of the time they used condoms. Something about the impossibility of the pregnancy was what made her keep the baby. That and a single sentence Kelly had said. I hope the baby has your eyes. Right away, as with millions of women before her, she had thought, but I hope he has yours. Sperm had met egg, and each of their thoughts had met the others, and she felt immediately ready, like she'd grown up in the space of a 2-minute pregnancy test, looking to a future generation instead of to herself. But she hadn't been ready, not at all. Nobody had warned her of the car crash that was labour. At one point she had been sure she was going to die, and that conviction never really left her, even after she was fine. She couldn't believe women went through that they chose to do it again and again. She couldn't believe pain like that actually existed. She had begun her motherhood journey with pain, but also in fear of the judgment of health visitors, of GPs, and of other mothers. Todd hadn't been what anybody would call a difficult baby. He'd always slept well, but an easy baby is still difficult, and Jen, a fan of self-recrimination anyway, was thrust into something that would in other circumstances have been described as torture. And yet to describe it as such was taboo. She'd looked down at him one night and thought, "How do I know if I love you?" Jen can see that she was susceptible to wanting it all. A woman working in a job that took as much as you were able to give, having a repressed father, vulnerable to people's judgment, to reading huge amounts into the small things people say. That vein of inadequacy running through her that led her to say yes to banal networking events and taking on more cases than she could realistically run led in parenthood to misery. She'd wanted to sleep in the same room as Todd for him to hear her breathing. She'd wanted to breastfeed. She'd wanted to do it perfectly, and maybe that was compensation for what she should have felt, but didn't. She'd tried to tell a health visitor about all this, but they had only looked uncomfortable and asked if she wanted to kill herself. No, Jen had said dully. She hadn't wanted to kill herself. She had wanted to take it back. She'd driven to work to see her father, walked around the office like a zombie. In the foyer, her father had hugged her extra tightly, but hadn't said anything. Hadn't been able to say anything. That she was doing a good job. Did she need help? A typical man of his generation. But it had still hurt. Like all disasters, it ebbed away, and the love bloomed big and beautiful when Todd started to do things, to sit up, to talk, to smear bourbon biscuits over his entire head. And until recently, when his friends had descended into teenage sullenness, he hadn't. Still full of puns, of laughs, of facts, just for her. At the beginning, the love she had felt for him had been eclipsed by how hard it had been in the early days, and it wasn't any longer. That was all. An explanation as big and as small as that. But she'd been too afraid to have any more children. She looks at the road unfolding in front of her now and thinks that the baby in the poster is a girl. She finds a little hard stone of regret in her stomach that she didn't have that other child, a sibling for Todd, somebody he could confide in, somebody who could help him now more than she can. She can't let it happen. She can't let the murder play out. She can't have him lose everything. her easy little baby who unknowingly witnessed his mother crying so often she can't bear for this to be his end. She can't bear for him to be bad. Let him, let him, let him and her be good.